Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hey, strangers. Thanks for stopping for the FlixWise podcast. I'm the omniscient narrator of this tale, Lady P. No relation to Master P. Joining me today is the editor of CinemaFanatic.com and the author of the A Year with Women series. She's one classy dame, Miss Mariah E. Gates.
Hi.
Hi. And peering through the horizontal blinds is a frequent guest and FlixWise co-producer, Mr. Martin Kessler.
Hello.
Hi. I need like a breathy hi.
I don't know if I can do a breathy hi. I'm Martin. A valley girl, man.
I need an Edward G. Robinson impression, please. Oh, no. All right. Not this time.
Maybe
when we do Double Indemnity.
Okay.
On today's show, we have yet another entry in our female filmmaker series. But this one's pulling double duty because it's also going to be our special Noir-vember episode. So not a long list of candidates that are both noirs and directed by women. But fortunately, there is one rather prominent example. So today I'm going to ask you to consider whether or not Ida Lupino's 1953 feature, The Hitchhiker, is worthy of the FlixWise favorites list. All right, you guys ready to hit the road?
Yes.
Ready.
All right, thumbs out. Today's FlixWise favorites entry is Ida Lupino's The Hitchhiker, a harrowing tale of a boy's weekend gone terribly awry. The film follows a pair of longtime pals, Roy and Gil, played by Edmund O'Brien and Frank Lovejoy, respectively, as they set out for a quiet fishing trip in the Arizona wilderness. But Roy, eager to make the most of his time away from the wife, decides he wants to have a spontaneous night of debauchery in Mexico, and Gil reluctantly indulges him. Along the way, they spot a man stranded along the side of the road and gallantly offer him a ride. This shadowy figure, played by William Tallman, remains obscured by darkness for the first few minutes of the journey. That is until he pulls a gun on Gil and Roy and forces them to do his bidding. Turns out this hitchhiker is a wanted psychopath named Emmett Myers. It was revealed earlier in the film that Emmett is a killer at large, suspected of murdering a pair of honeymooners. His plan now is to use Gil and Roy as cover as he makes his escape to Santa Rosalia, Mexico. He tells his pair of captives that he'll only kill them if he has to. The film follows as Gil and Roy diligently drive Emmett through the desolate Baja California landscape, all while trying to decide whether they should devise an escape or wait it out and see if Emmett keeps his word on the whole not killing them promise. Now, normally this is the part of the podcast where I lay out the case for why the film should be considered one of the greatest of all time, but the truth is I'm still on the fence about The Hitchhiker's canon worthiness. On the one hand, this is a taut psychological thriller, and William Tallman plays among the most menacing villains of the noir genre. Plus, it also happens to have the distinction of being the first film noir directed by a female, and some say the only true film noir directed by a female. I'm sure, Mariah, you can qualify that statement, but I must admit that I feel some resistance in saying this is among the most essential pieces of cinema ever made, and I'm hoping Martin and Mariah can help sway me one way or another. All right, Mariah, do you like The Hitchhiker?
I love this movie. It's one of my favorites. I've seen it several times.
Okay. All right. Well, then you're Team Hitchhiker. Martin, how about you?
I really liked it. There's one or two things I didn't like about the movie, but it might be because I'm still sort of digesting it. I just watched this film for the first time 2 days ago. So it's all pretty fresh to me. But this is kind of my favorite type of Hollywood film, the sort of middle to low budget genre picture that has some interesting ideas woven in. Like, I could probably watch this film another 100 times.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, there's a lot to digest. I've only seen it twice, and it gets richer with every experience, and the more I think about it, the more I like it. But Mariah, what is it that you love about it?
I remember the first time I saw it was on TCM, and it's only like, it's just shy of an hour, right? It's like an hour and 5 minutes or something.
Yeah, an hour and 10 minutes.
And it's so like engrossing from start to finish. It reminded me of The Most Dangerous Game, which is also like 70 minutes, and it's from start to finish just tension, tension, tension. And I love films that do that, that are all meat and no you know, no fat, no filling.
Right. Right. There is no subplot.
No.
There's no B plot. It's all just the story. I suppose you could count the story of the investigation that's happening simultaneously, but they cut away from that so infrequently
mm-hmm.
that, you know, mm-hmm. like there's no, the tension just builds and builds and it doesn't really let up.
And then, like you said, the villain is so menacing mm-hmm. and he's like, there's no redemptive qualities about him at all. It's before we wanted to have villains that we could empathize with.
Right.
Like, he's just evil.
Right. Exactly.
And he has that weird eye,
which is great. Dude is creepy, for sure. All right, but so Martin, what? Let's pick apart your opening statement. What do you like about it, and what are your reservations?
Well, like you said, the leanness is something I really admire. Like, nothing really feels superfluous or indulgent, and I really love that. It's very tense. It's very scary. I mean, at times I was thinking it felt to me almost more like a horror film than it did a typical film noir. But
right. I had that exact same reaction. I thought this is, I wasn't clear. Like, there was more, I don't know if this falls exclusively in the noir category, because it really does have the structure of a horror film.
It does. And like, on top of that, the sort of ghoulish face of the villain and like those big American cars driving at night, they look almost like monsters to me. And so I really like that. What I did like about it is, well, I guess the ending was the big letdown for me. I sort of felt like it had all this forward momentum and it was really building to some kind of either some big existential gut punch or some kind of subversion of that. And instead it kind of just ends on a whimper, which for a film like this, to have it end with, you know, we caught the bad guy, he's going off to jail, and it felt kind of like a little cliche or a little typical, while the rest of the movie didn't. I thought the rest felt exceptional.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you rather he die? Is that the kind of ending you wanted, or?
Well, I felt like I would rather just have something that was more intellectually rewarding.
Yeah, it felt like there was a lot of attention paid to the gun and the use of the gun, and like that recalled for me Chekhov's gun, and it's almost like we see this gun and it doesn't go off. So there's something very narratively unsatisfying about that.
And there's like so many allusions to this being a film about death, like when they're talking about like, oh, Santa Rosa Lia, that's the end of the line, and you never know when you're gonna die, but it's gonna happen, and all these things are sort of put in your head. And it almost feels like they're like them driving down this road. It's like driving down the road of life. You're going to reach this inevitable conclusion that's death. And I thought, like, either you can kind of turn into that or maybe flip that on its head in some way and subvert it. But I didn't find the ending to be especially satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Mariah, what do you think?
Well, I'm just trying to think what kind of ending would have been more satisfying, because you, at one way or the other, at this time in Hollywood cinema, the bad guy has to get his comeuppance. It's like part of the code. It wouldn't have passed like inspection if they didn't. So he either has to die or he has to get arrested.
Yeah.
I think it works having him get arrested.
Can I tell you what I would have done?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm really interested.
I think Roy should have killed him.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of allusions to him morphing into Myers or Emmett. Mm-hmm. What with the jacket and everything. And he's clearly the more high-strung, the more aggressive of the two captives. And it's sort of implied or inferred that he's kind of a mirror in some ways of the serial killer. Like, there's certainly some kind of relationship there. And the resentment feels very personal. Obviously, like, he's taken him captive. He has every right to be pissed, but his reaction, it seemed like the film wants to imply that they aren't all that different. We aren't all that different, you and I. Anyway.
Well, I guess, you know, like, following that, then having neither of them kill him is maybe Lupino's way of saying that there isn't a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And that the difference is that if these two guys really were the flip of the coin, one of them would have killed them, but they didn't, so they're not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That could be what she was saying.
Right, right.
I don't know. But.
Yeah. I guess then that begs the question, why are there two of them? What are they, what is the dichotomy there? What is their, how do our two protagonists play off of each other, and how does that relate to the villain? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that this is posited between the end of the World War II and the beginning of the Korean conflict, and how masculinity is often, was prior to that, the lone hero. And like, now we're going back into war, and it's not about the lone hero when you're in war.
Mm-hmm.
It's about working together.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's like little philosophical questions raised about how each of them might be able to escape on his own, but it would mean the death for the other. And that connection to the war, like, I think he says it was his first time leaving his wife and family since the war. And I think this implication is like they're going back to war, you know, the way the United States is maybe going back to war in Korea, which I think was going on around the same time as this film.
Right.
Maybe.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, no, absolutely.
I definitely think this is because it's the end. It's the later half of the noir era, and it's the going back into war, because you had the like early 40s films were really a reaction to returning to normalcy, returning to a life that you thought you had, and it's not the same anymore. And that's where a lot of that angst in the 40s films comes from. And then 50s, we're back in like wartime America, and everything is different.
It definitely does capture the sort of feelings of the times, like the sort of existential terror of Cold War America. I think that's very prevalent in this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that element certainly struck me. And as I was watching it, it was comforting to know that this so-called crisis of masculinity that everyone likes to talk about now has been going on at least since the 50s, if not longer, if not since we've started distinguishing between men and women. Like since the dawn of man, man has been feeling inferior to other men. So. Yeah.
Let's put that on a mug.
Yeah. Did this film remind anyone else of Deliverance?
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, just that whole, they're out on a fishing trip, they're escaping the bosom of domesticity in suburbia, but it turns out, you know, horrors await them in the jungle, or in this case, in the desert.
Yeah, I could definitely see this as an inspiration on Deliverance.
Yeah.
It's a very similar sort of evil that's disrupted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also the whole idea that, like, dudes need to get away from their wife in order to be real men.
Mm-hmm.
I hate that.
Yeah.
I hate that. Like,
I thought it was interesting that it's the wedding ring that's left behind that kind of leads the police to find them at the end. So I think like that was a little bit Lupino commenting on marriage.
I think this was right about when Lupino and Collier Young were breaking, because he started shipping Joan Fontaine.
Mm-hmm.
And after they made a movie, all three of them together, which is like super awkward to watch later on.
Yep.
Because they're the other women for the main guy in that one. So it's like life imitating art. But I think part of what makes this such a powerful film by a woman is how much, how there are no women, and people comment on that. Like, the women aren't shown, but like the presence of women and the importance of women in people's lives is like an undercurrent.
Mm-hmm.
That is mm-hmm. so strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is our second film in our series that was directed by a woman that is that's about men and about male interaction.
Dude bonding.
Yep. Bromance, if you will.
only this time it was fishing and not surfing.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Very similar. They both involve bodies of water.
and California.
And California. But there, unfortunately, is no skydiving in this one.
Come on, Lupino.
Get on that. That is the film's main shortcoming, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't want the big skydiving climax, yeah.
Exactly. That would have been an ending. Anyway. So, I don't know, Martin, you're a dude. Right?
I'm pretty sure I'm a dude. What? Yeah.
Yeah. So does this film get male interaction right? Because we talk a lot about how when women direct films about females, there are certain subtleties that women pick up on that a male director may not. And I'm wondering if the reverse is also the case, where a female director may not quite get the subtleties of male bonding, or if that's just not an issue. And that's also painting with a really broad brush. Like, that's not to say men can't successfully showcase a female friendship or a pair of females interacting.
I don't know. Like, I mean, there's so many different filmmakers with different varied points of view or insight. I think she does, even though it's a masculinity that's very specific, I think, to that particular time period.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems authentic to me. Like, there's that moment when they're driving into this town and one friend kind of looks to the other if they want to go and see the banana dance or strip show or whatever it was.
Right.
And he kind of shrugs it off and he's saying, you know, sorry, not tonight, pal. Like, that felt like an authentic moment to me. And mm-hmm. it sort of captured the essence of the dude bonding of that era, I think.
Mm. Dude bonding of that era. Is there a more era appropriate name for dude bonding? That was not a thing. We'll have to come up with something. Yeah. Anyway. So let's talk about Mexico and the way Mexico or Mexicali is portrayed in the film, which was actually one of the things that I found most fascinating.
So I think this is our right around when we had a big insurgence of Mexican farm workers coming in. They started coming in the 50s and 60s, and that became this like opening to California that was a little freaky to a lot of people who were, like, not used to it. Even though L.A. was always a really huge, had a huge Latino population, there was, like, families that had lived there for, you know, a long time, and some people were used to it. But, like, now there's foreigners coming in, and then, but at the same time, Mexico became this, like, place to go because Cuba was gone
mm-hmm.
as an option. And so you had a combination of, like, workers coming in and taking jobs, and then a new, like, place to go have fun,
mm-hmm.
all combined into one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But in this area, movie, it's like there's this Wild West feel. Like, again, there's the domestic comfort of the comfort of the United States versus the exoticism, the sort of forbiddenness of the foreign.
It's actually in several noirs, they have that same sort of thing. There's one with Gloria Graham that I can't remember the name of right now, and Sterling Hayden,
mm-hmm.
where she's like a prostitute on the border there. And
well, there's Touch of Evil,
and then Touch of Evil is the most famous one.
Ride the Pick Horse.
Which
Robert Montgomery? Yeah.
Yeah.
Which one's that?
Ride the Pick Horse.
It's based on a Dorothy B. Hughes novel, I think.
I'll have to check it out. This is a prevalent thing at the time. Touch of Evil was
58.
Oh, I was off by 10 years.
It's often considered the last, like, bang of the noir era before we get into, like, neo-noir.
Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Except at least in this one, there's no brown face.
That's true.
No brown face.
Yes, yeah.
Thank you, Lupino.
Yeah.
They didn't have the budget for brown face.
They had to hire actual... I don't know if they were Mexican or people of Latin American heritage. Like,
I don't know.
But that I really appreciated how the Mexican characters were portrayed. There were no stereotypes. They didn't even use subtitles, at least in the version that I saw.
Yeah, I don't think so. Not in the original version.
Okay, yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah, so it's just, it really, there's a lot of respect for all of the characters. Well, they may have had small parts, they weren't there for comic relief, which would have been much very, very easy to do.
And it's interesting that the main characters feel more comfortable than the villain, who's sort of telling them not to speak the language and feels very sort of out of place in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think that means?
I think it's sort of showing that, like, for me anyway, that you're not supposed to feel alienated by the Mexican characters.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're not really supposed to side with the villain.
Right.
I think it's a kind of a class distinction, too, is, like, the two guys have probably interacted with lots of different people and have maybe even studied Spanish at some point, whereas the villain is from a very lower class where... the whole idea of strangers is even more prevalent.
Totally, yeah. And the Gil, who is the draftsman, So he's like, he's supposed to be slightly more educated, and he's the one who speaks Spanish. So mm-hmm. again, that's the other connection between Roy and Emmett, where they, I think they're both, you know, foreign. Whereas, and also I think Gil's reaction to Mexico is very different than Roy's. He's always very measured in how he approaches everything, including being a captive. But even in going to Mexico, he's the one who says, well, like, sorry, buddy, we're not going to the strip show tonight or whatever. And he's obviously more familiar with the culture because he speaks Spanish. So it's so just another way to draw a distinction. But we've talked about this a little bit, particularly the Myers performance. But let's talk about the other performances. We have Edmund O'Brien.
I love him.
Edmund O'Brien.
He's so good.
I know. And Frank Lovejoy. Edmund O'Brien plays Roy, and Frank Lovejoy plays Gil. Edmund O'Brien is kind of a mainstay for Lupino. When I saw this movie, I was like, hey, it's The Bigamist, which is another Lupino film. But what did you think of their performances?
I think what I particularly like is their chemistry together. They really feel like bros. They feel like they've known each other forever. They mm-hmm. know what, you know, and they respect each other's opinions on things, mm-hmm. which is good. So, like, when the one guy is like, no, the other guy is disappointed, but he's not going to goad him into doing it because he knows it's against his character.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I thought that felt really true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Martin, how about you?
Yeah, you said it. I mean, they sort of bring a life to these two people that lets you empathize with them. Otherwise, I think you might have just felt like, oh, these are two guys who are dumb enough to pick up a hitchhiker. I think those performances make the characters work.
Well, that's another interesting aspect to the film is the fact that picking up hitchhikers since the Great Depression and even earlier was a real thing people did, and it was not scary, and it was a normal way to move across the country because everything was so expensive. Mm-hmm. And the few people who had motors, you know, felt like it was the American thing to do. And this is like showing, this is why it's so noir, is it's showing like, yeah, it's the American thing to do until you pick up the wrong one. And then, like you can kind of argue that an entire, this goes to your point about it being kind of like a horror film, an entire subgenre of horror is based on this happening. Mm-hmm. And it's based on a true story. So it's like a way of looking at a big change in American life that you can't actually pick up strangers anymore.
Totally. Yeah. That whole stranger danger.
Yeah. That wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
Now, you know, actually my friend Trevor picks up hitchhikers in Kansas all the time. And I'm like, dude,
watch yourself.
You know, he's seen the hitchhiker too. He should know better, but he doesn't.
And I feel like we've sort of touched on this, but what makes this a film noir? Is it purely the lighting, or are there other tropes?
I think from the technical aspect, yes. Like, it's got all the technical marks of noir. But for me, it's the thematic idea that it's exposing the underbelly of American life mm-hmm. is what really makes it a noir. Because that's what so many noirs did, and that was why that era is so fascinating, is it took the sheen off of everything. Right. And so like you can't even go fishing.
Right.
You're gonna die.
Right, right.
Don't exactly. Go fishing.
Yep. An innocent, yeah.
Well, you also get a little bit of the sense of like certain, I might have been reading too much into this, but like I was sort of thinking how the villain has this leather jacket and he's kind of this sadistic character who makes them walk on broken ankles, and it kind of made me think about how this is like right around the time that the fetish BDSM leather subculture was forming, and like I think this is right around the time that Kenneth Anger started making films, and I like you almost feel like this kind of it's not explicit in any way, but you almost feel like the roots of the subculture in this character, and I think we're supposed to view him as being at least a little bit perverse, like mm-hmm. that moment when he makes one of the men strip to switch the clothes. Like I think like you're not really meant to infer something, but like it still doesn't feel, at least through the eyes of how I think people would have seen the film at the time, like it doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it definitely is not something you would see in any other, like, type of film.
Yes. Yeah.
Forced stripping is just not...
Right. Exactly. Yeah. No, there's no other reason for that scene to be there aside from... It definitely felt... It definitely felt a little bit... It was there for the sadism. It's, yeah, yet another element. I mean, you can't, obviously you cannot show, a rape scene. You certainly cannot show a male rape scene, but, or male on male rape scene, but, Ida Lupino was not one to shy away from that subject. In fact, I believe one of her first films that she directed.
Outraged.
Yeah. So she's not one to shy away from that sort of subject matter. So, when I watched it, I thought there's nothing explicitly homoerotic about it, but that is what that scene, that is what is yeah. you're meant to, that is what it's certainly suggestive.
Yeah. Like you just look at the body language in the following scene, the way these guys are sort of slumped over and just like, they look like they've been through something. It's very uncomfortable to look at. And like, it's sort of interesting if you contrast this with like other, slightly queer film noir villains, like that there's kind of a history of that, but they're usually more like I think of Peter Lorre and Maltese Falcon being slapped around by Humphrey Bogart being like, you'll take it and you'll like it. Like it's a very different type of kind of queer villain, so like it felt unusual in that way to me, but I thought it's possible I'm reading too much into this, but that's kind of what I got out
no
of,
I don't think
the,
you
the
are I think
so.
I think it's there, yeah. There's nothing, like you said, it's not explicit, but I think it's certainly there. Let's talk about other Ida Lupino films.
I've actually only seen The Bigamist.
Okay. I actually really like The Bigamist.
It's so good.
I really like that movie. Yep. In fact, I think I might like it a little bit better than this one.
I mean, I just watched it this morning, so it's even fresher in my mind than The Hitchhiker. But I think, like, narratively, it's more satisfying. Like, it's, you know, when you get that look of the between the two wives at the end.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot going in
film.
It's really fascinating. I think maybe the direction doesn't feel as stylish as The Hitchhiker, which might be the reason why people kind of gravitate more towards it, but like I really like
people
the
also
too.
Gravitate more towards it because it's not about two women.
Yes.
Too.
Yeah.
So. I mean,
yeah.
Totally. Who cares about women?
Yeah. No, that's exactly what it is. The Bigamist is a melodrama. This is a film noir.
I would argue that The Bigamist is a melodramatic film noir.
Okay. All right.
But that's just me.
Well, like, yeah, the flashbacks and the kind of California setting, like, it made me think a little of, like, Sunset Boulevard or something.
Okay,
like,
It kind of does have, like, a Mildred Pierce-y vibe.
I think so.
Yeah.
And like, when they're talking about, like, Barbara Stanwyck, when they're driving around, it's...
She works in, like, a Chinatown dive. It's totally film noir.
It's
like,
true. Yeah.
It's all filmed around Bunker Hill.
Yeah. It's true. But that was exactly my reaction, because this is the... easily her most popular movie, at least in your poll.
Yeah.
Right?
I think in general, people think Ida Lupino, often I feel like people think Ida Lupino directed one film, you know, and then they find out that she directed other films and for a few decades and a lot of television. She directed a lot of television. Mm-hmm. That's why my mom didn't know she made films. She knew she directed television. And then I told her about her films and she was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
You know, so
yep.
Well, her television work is so prolific, and like all the while watching The Hitchhiker, I kept thinking like this sort of reminds me of the feel of Alfred Hitchcock Presents or Twilight Zone. And then of course I went on their IMDb right after, and like it makes sense that she directed memorable episodes of those, and just so much television. I think you can see why that might have even have been a better arena for her than film, because like she seems to work well with smaller budgets and like just has that kind of tight pace that you need to get a story to fit into the length of a television episode.
Precisely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I agree.
Yep. Before we get to deciding whether or not this belongs in the FlixWise favorites list, I do kind of want to talk a little bit more about the ending and whether or not the ending will be the reason why it doesn't make it. And I'm not saying there can't be multiple Ida Lupino films in the list, but I think I prefer The Bigamist mostly because it is narratively more satisfying, as Martin, you said. But maybe if we keep talking about it enough, I will come around on the ending to Hitchhiker. So Mariah, I think you're the one who has no misgivings about this.
Yeah, no, I think it ended how it was always going to end. I don't think those two guys are murderers, and I think that's what Lupino's trying to say, and I think that's why they don't shoot him, because ultimately, whether it's in self-defense or not, you still committed murder, and I don't think she wanted that for those characters. I don't think she thought those characters deserved the psychological aftermath of that, and I think that's part of why she didn't have that ending that way. Because if either one of them killed him, one, the whole they need each other dissolved because only one of them needed to kill him. So then her whole buildup of they need each other is destroyed. Then, you know, she's clearly someone who understands that the horrors of life affect you beyond when it happens. Because that's why this guy is nuts. And I think she respects that, and that's why she doesn't want that to happen to her characters. At least not in this little part of their life.
Right. So, Martin, what do you think about the ending? Where are you? What side of the fence are you on?
For some reason, I'm much more forgiving of a film starting weak and ending strong than the other way around. But I don't necessarily think that perfection is, like, a prerequisite for greatness, and, like, up to the end, the whole time, I was just saying to myself how great this film is. So, like, I don't think I'm on board with the ending, but
I
don't know if it's, like, the biggest. I don't think it necessarily kills the movie for me either.
Okay, I think I'm far more forgiving of a weak ending. I guess in this period, just because I know that they were constrained by the rules of the production code.
At least it's not like the end of The Bad Seed.
Yeah.
All right, talk about a bad ending to a superb film.
The one that kills me is Gilda.
Oh. Yeah.
That movie is great up until the ending. Like, no.
Yeah.
No.
But, like, I was thinking, I mean, France had similar restrictions, and then you have somebody like Jean-Pierre Melville sort of doing these subversive endings that kind of played into what was allowed but made you feel completely different than the way you were supposed to. Like, I think there were ways around the Hays Code.
You had to be clever about it.
Otto
Preminger,
right?
He didn't even care.
He just did what he wanted.
Yeah, he did what he wanted.
I think this is actually the same year The Moon is Blue came out. Also 53, and he just released it without the code. He was like not rated because they say virgin. They say virgin. Oh.
I'm surprised she got away with The Bigamist.
I know.
She gets away with a lot in both films. Yeah.
It's good having a low budget.
Exactly, yeah. I guess it's kind of an unassuming movie. But it had backing by Howard Hughes.
I think she also is able to get away with a little bit on this one because it's based on a true story. Some of the weird quirks, she could always argue, like, oh, I did research. You know what I mean? Like, who knows if she did that, like, with the board or whatever, but there's that idea that perhaps the weird quirks were really,
right, this
like,
actually
happened.
And,
like,
yeah.
Hey.
Yeah.
Who am I to change history?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So, I don't know. Should we put it to a vote? Are we ready to do that? Have we parsed through? I mean, we haven't talked too much about the cinematography or any of the directorial choices, but was there anything of note that really struck you as far, visually speaking?
I love the sequence at the beginning when they first picked him up and he's in the back of the car and the tension there, even from the beginning, even though at first they aren't worried, but like you as the viewer kind of know like this is not good.
Yeah.
And not just because you know not just because you're seeing a Hitchhiker movie, but like
Just cause, not just because you've seen the poster.
Yeah, but like because of his body language and things that you see as a viewer that they don't see.
Mm-hmm.
I think the way she framed that was really effective.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I really love like the contrast between these like claustrophobic car interiors at night, where the darkness is kind of surrounding them, to like the completely isolating daytime expanses when they're in the desert. Like, it's great stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Really great use of the desert.
Mm-hmm.
Very different than what you would see in a Western, where that expansiveness is freedom,
mm-hmm.
right? And in this, somehow, it's expansive in the same way, but it's so, like you yeah. said, claustrophobic mm-hmm. and terrifying and isolating. And instead of, like, I'm in the free open range, it's more like, oh my god, I'm in the middle of nowhere with a psycho, I'm gonna die.
Yeah, totally. Well, I really like this movie. I like it a lot, despite my misgivings about the ending. But I almost wish we'd done like a versus episode with The Bigamist.
Yeah.
Because like,
yep. Yeah.
I really.
Can we just have like a double feature Ida Lupino favorite?
I think so. We could do that.
I'm cool with that.
Okay. I didn't give everyone a little primer on The Bigamist, but it's basically about just what it sounds like. It's about a dude who's married to two different, very lovely women, and that's basically what it's about. And what's remarkable about it is that despite his moral, despite having sort of a morally reprehensible character, I mean, he's also very sympathetic. And I love movies where you don't have a villain.
You have these two women, different. Uh-huh. That's what I'm trying to say. Sorry. You know, one who's sort of a lower class, and in a film by a lesser director, and probably a male director, would be a whore, right? Mm-hmm. But she's never painted that mm-hmm. way. And you have this, like, new business savvy woman who wants to be a mom, who would be the Madonna character in like a lesser film, like in a Lubitsch film. And instead, my least favorite Madonna horror movie is a Lubitsch film. But instead,
which one?
The Smiling Lieutenant.
Oh, okay.
I hate that movie. Sorry. Okay. But instead, you just have two very different women,
mm-hmm.
complex women,
mm-hmm.
who aren't Madonnas or whores.
Mm-hmm.
They're just women.
Right.
And that's the importance of having a female director
mm-hmm.
and a female writer, and Ida Lupino in general.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That film is remarkable. And I love, as you say, it was all shot. There's so many scenes that are shot on location.
Yeah.
It's such a great snapshot of Los Angeles.
Since we're talking about LA noir, there's a great book that I want to plug a little bit.
Okay.
That's called Bunker Hill. And there's, like, a really long subtitle on it. It's, like, the birthplace of film noir or something like that. But just type in Bunker Hill and noir, and you'll find it. And it's great. And they tell you all the movies that were shot there and the locations and some of the places that you can still go to.
Very cool.
And ooh, it's like an illustrated, like, guide of the film noirs that were filmed there. And it's A-okay.
Awesome. Awesome. Let's do the tour.
Those tour rides are crazy. We'll do like our own tour.
We'll do our own tour.
I meant to do it last year and yeah. I had car problems.
Oh no. Okay. Well, we can do our own tour.
Yeah.
It's fine. Anyway.
I have all the directions.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, if listeners want to join us on our very own Los Angeles
noir tour.
Yeah. We're doing it. anyway, Martin, so The Bigamist. We're doing a double feature here. The Bigamist versus The Hitchhiker.
Apparently.
you never know where things are going to go on the FlixWise podcast. But you're in the Bigamist versus The Hitchhiker debate. Or did you have any additional thoughts on The Bigamist?
Oh. I mean, it's really great melodrama, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of interesting because, like, on the surface, it sort of seems like a typical kind of morality drama.
Mm-hmm.
And just all the little nuances in the characters, that's what really kind of makes
yeah.
it for me. And I think, like,
absolutely,
even though there's not really like a relationship between the two women, there's sort of a vicarious relationship between them that you get. And then at the end, I feel like once the guy's out of the picture, that sort of leaves them in a place that I thought was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, a little torn between these two films because I think they're both great, but like I kind of have to go The Biggest, if only because like the Hitchhiker already seems to have a lot of attention on it. Like it's like the National Film Archive, the Library of Congress, like that's almost better company than the Sight and Sound list. That's very prestigious.
Yes, it is.
I mean, not only do they have Airplane, they have like Carmen Jones, The Thin Man, Alien Hoop Dreams, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Cabaret. It's like
all
amazing films. Yeah.
Yes. So, and like, The Big Lebowski.
And a lot of those Muppet are already movie. On the FlixWise favorites list. So
yeah.
So like, yeah, why aren't we doing the Library of Congress podcast?
Yeah, Martin.
It's
oh
a really
God.
Long list. Every year you can write into the National Film Archive with up to 100 films that you think should be included. And that's part of how they choose the list.
Ah.
So every year I send in a list and at the top is Picnic because I love Picnic.
Okay.
And then and then everything else after that. So if you're listening,
National
you
Film
can
Archive.
Write in. You can write into the National Film Archive and vote for The Big Miss.
Okay. Yes. I certainly think it's worthy. In fact, like I said, like we're underdog people here, so I think I'm gonna vote in The Bigamist, and it's a write-in election apparently.
This is how Bette Davis won her first Oscar. So.
Yeah, write-ins.
Wait, no, she was not. Oh, no, that's how she got her first nomination.
Okay,
it was a write-in
was that
nomination
of Human Bondage. What was
yeah,
it? Was it okay?
It's not a real nomination.
Interesting.
Bette Davis doesn't need real nominations.
No. Bette Davis doesn't need awards. Like, she's already.
She is an award.
Yeah, she's just a human statue that, yeah, she that she hands out to us all.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Anyway. yeah, so I'm going to go with the Bigamist on this one. Mariah.
Can I vote for both of them?
We can. Do you think both are worthy of the
I think both
list?
Are worthy, yes,
okay,
but
right.
for different reasons.
Okay, yeah, I like them both a whole lot, so it's really hard. But, Martin, I know, final word. I'm putting it, is it which one's going on the FlixWise favorites list?
I think they're both great films, but I think The Bigamist is the more satisfying film, so I just kind of have to give it to The Bigamist, like, on... The Hitchhiker's so entertaining, though. Jeez.
I know. To me, The Bigamist feels more like the more unusual film.
Yeah, it's I mean, like, there are very atypical elements when you're looking at The Hitchhiker in the context of film noir, but like The Bigamist, it's hard to fit that into any kind of I'm probably gonna have to dive back into it and look at it with a more discerning eye, but like off the bat I think that's the film that I preferred, so I vote The Bigamist.
I'm gonna go with The Bigamist, so I think we just put The Bigamist. Okay. Awesome.
That's a
all
real
right.
upset episode.
I know. but whatever you do, people, don't, like, actually, you know what I would like us all to do? Watch Hard, Fast, and Beautiful.
Oh, I've seen that one, too.
Really?
I forgot about that one. The
I
tennis
hated
one.
That
no,
one.
It's great. It's great. It's great. It's great. Okay, everyone, no, it's,
don't listen to
her. You can get it from Warner Archive Collection, and it's like those pageant moms. But, like, in the 50s and as a tennis mom instead. So she's pushing her daughter to be a huge tennis star for the perks. It's amazing. It's amazing. If you look at it and think about all of these, like, talent mom shows that are so popular right now, they've been doing that for 70 years. And probably, well, way before that, because, like, even, like, Gypsy Rose Lee's mom was like that. It's mm-hmm. it's great.
Oh, yeah. The stage mom has been around
since
the stage.
It's a takedown of the stage mom.
Yeah, yeah.
But set in the sports world.
Yes.
So then there's also sexism. It's great.
Yes.
What are you talking about? I forgot I'd seen that.
We'll get into it another day. yeah, because I definitely want to have that discussion. But
that would be a good double feature with Mildred Pierce.
Yeah. Okay.
Making plans.
Yes, indeed. All right. Next time. And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise, that is. Listeners, would you give The Hitchhiker a lift in your car? How about The Bigamist? Come tell us on our website, flixwise.com. And be sure to make a stop on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flixwise. Also, you're going to want to follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flixwise. But your ultimate destination should be iTunes, where you're going to give us a good reading and leave us a shiny new comment, right? Right. Because that'll really help us stand out in the iTunes database. On our next show, we're going to enjoy some of the sweet life with the 39th movie on the Sight and Sound list. It's Federico Fellini's La Dolce Vita.
I want to marry Marcello Mastroianni. Because I just want to look at his face.
Yes, Marcello.
That's the power of Marcello.
Okay, but until then, Martin, thank you so much for watching a pair of Lupino movies with us.
Thanks, I'm glad I could watch them. This was a great introduction.
Yes, check those off your list. Mariah, thank you for coming on. I should mention, I believe this will be our final entry in our women-directed series for this year.
Oh.
I know. But I have no doubt we will continue putting female-made films up for the list. And, I mean, because we haven't done Tank Girl yet, and,
Tank Girl, yeah. Ain't nothing like Tank Girl.
You don't like Tank Girl.
Love it or hate it, there's nothing else like it.
Yes. Who hates Tank Girl?
Some people hate Tank Girl.
That's ridiculous.
Well, they're wrong.
I know they are wrong.
Anyway. But Mariah, thank you so much for inspiring this female filmmaker series. And listeners, if you haven't already, you should definitely check out Mariah's A Year with Women series on Cinema Fanatics and on Tumblr, Old Films Flickr. So thank you so much for inspiring this.
I'm glad to do that. That was my goal with the year, was to get more people talking about not just new films by women, but old films by women, because they've always been making films.
Yeah.
The first narrative film was made by a woman.
There you go. Is that Alice?
Alice Gee.
So until next time, we're off to go see if we can hook a few. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
American Thanksgiving. Gosh.
American Thanksgiving. Yes.
happy Noirvember.
Yes, and happy Noirvember. Precisely. Yes, indeed. All right.